You're listening to Wadcast, a podcast from Wadham College, University of Oxford, bringing you interviews, seminars and stories from our community.
The voice you just heard is one of our students, Hannah Ledley. Congratulations, Hannah. She is the winner of our competition to be the voice of Wadcast's intro. I'm your host for this episode. My name's Martin. I work at Wadham College in Web, Media and Communications. For this episode, I interview Philip Bullock, our fellow and tutor in Russian. He'll introduce himself properly in the podcast, so let's just jump straight in. Here it is, Wadcast Episode 1. Well, thank you, Philip, for your time.
It's a pleasure to be here and talking to you.
Yeah, and here is, in fact, in your office, which is very fun, so thank you for generously opening that up.
Well, even if people can't see it, I hope they can imagine us sitting surrounded by my books, my desk, and my piano in the corner of the room.
It's a very Oxford-y setting. It's very nice. So maybe you could just begin by explaining who you are at Wadham in particular, but just generally, kind of your professional bio.
Yes, so I'm a fellow and tutor in Russian, and I've been in that post since 2007, so quite some time now. My history with Wadham goes back further, though. I did my doctorate here back in the late 1990s, and I was also the organ scholar during that period for 3 years. So I have a very long association with the college and a very happy one as well.
Does that mean you play the organ?
I do. I play the organ and the piano badly and mostly in private.
Maybe we can change that in the near future. That's great. So one of the reasons I'm talking to you, besides that you're an intrinsically interesting person, is that you have recently come out with a book on a Russian composer. Now, I'm not going to pronounce the name of this composer because I'm going to let you take the first stab at that and show me the way.
So the composer is Rachmaninoff, Sergei Vasilievich Rachmaninoff, but let's just call him Rachmaninoff.
Okay. Rachmaninoff.
Indeed, molodets.
Okay, I was kind of wondering whether it would be disrespectful to call him Sergei. So.
No, if we were to meet him in person, we would probably call him Sergei Vasilievich.
Okay.
Russians, when you meet them, are always addressed by their first name and their patronymic. If we were very good friends and knew him, we might call him Seryozha in a private setting.
Sure.
But in Europe, he was often known as Serge because his name was Europeanized when he was traveling, which he did a lot of in Europe in his life.
Great. So maybe expanding on that, maybe you could give us a first pass as to who this character is.
I think everybody listening surely knows something about him. He is probably one of the most famous classical composers of all time. I had a quick look before we met, and he's always come number two in the Classic FM Hall of Fame. He was born in 1873 in Russia. And he died in 1943, just shy of his 70th birthday, in Beverly Hills, in emigration. He'd left Russia in 1917 after the October Revolution. And he's, as I said, incredibly well known as a classical composer. He was also a virtuoso pianist, possibly one of the very last people to be both a composer and a pianist. There were plenty in the 19th century. It's much less common in our own age. And he's also, which is much less known, one of the greatest conductors of the early 20th century. So he combined three professions in one body and lived his life across two halves of the world.
It's quite impressive.
And you know, we know him for things like the Second Piano Concerto, perhaps. That's the piece that crops up in the Classic FM Hall of Fame. People might know that work from films such as Brief Encounter, where it forms the backdrop to the non-affair between the two lead characters. If you're not into all of that black and white melodrama, you might know The 7-Year Itch, a wonderful comedy starring Marilyn Monroe, which also features the Second Piano Concerto and Rachmaninoff's music, or more recently Shine, about the pianist Jeffrey Heathcote and that features the third concerto, but he composed in all genres. There are three symphonies, more than 80 songs, three operas, two major liturgical works for the Orthodox Church, some chamber music. I mean, he was a prodigious in terms of output. And a certain amount of that repertoire is extremely, possibly excessively familiar. And that's also an interesting factor when working on him. He's a composer about whom many musicologists have been rather snooty. He's too popular to be serious. He appeals too much to the masses to be worth looking at in scholarly terms. And I'm very keen to challenge that view, but also to celebrate his popularity. It's absolutely wonderful working on a composer who most people you meet will at least have heard of, and in many cases who will know and love an awful lot of his music.
Yeah, it's interesting that you note his extreme popularity. I guess I'd be interested to know whether you have any thoughts on why it's become as popular as he has.
Yes, and I'm sure there are lots of pieces you would know. I mean, he's great at producing earworms. yeah, he was an amazing melodist and always believed that melody was the great secret for success in writing a composition. I think the reason that he is so popular is that right until his death in 1943, he was writing music that many people recognize as traditional classical music, concertos, symphonies. It's melodic, its harmonies are rich and romantic, but they're certainly not difficult and off-putting. So his music did appeal to the tastes of a wide range of listeners. And that was a very deliberate strategy on his part. He wasn't an ivory tower figure. He didn't believe in cutting himself off and communing with his muse and his inspiration. He very much thought that his duty as a musician was to address as wide an audience as he possibly could, both as a composer and as a pianist and as a conductor. And that is one of the reasons, you know, behind his the critical dismissal of a lot of his work was that in the 20th century, and that's the great century of modernism and the avant-garde of Stravinsky, of Schoenberg, of those composers who developed a much more astringent, difficult, exclusive musical language, frankly, and who thought that was the direction of musical progress. Now, I revere both Schoenberg and Stravinsky, but their success in determining the kind of critical framework through which 20th century music was written, which was this triumph of modernism and the avant-garde, was very negative for tonal, accessible composers such as Rachmaninoff, who seem on the surface to be continuing a kind of 19th century late romantic musical language. Now, I think that's not altogether true in other ways, but certainly the reason for his continued appeal is that he's not going to frighten anyone who's put off by difficulty. His music is deliberately accessible, and he celebrates that accessibility, and well, I'm very happy with that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think the stereotype, certainly, of kind of contemporary or contemporary-ish classical music is that it is very hard to get into. My brother actually studied music at Manchester, and I think I attended one or two of the concerts that they put on, and I didn't leave particularly appreciative. He will be sad to hear. At this point in the audio, I stumbled over Rachmaninoff's name to a staggering degree. But essentially, I just commented that Rachmaninoff seemed to be at the cutoff point for most people when it came to appreciation of classical music. And Philip had some comments to add to that.
He forms an interesting bridge as well into that world, because he did live so late, dying in 1943, and writing music that sounded 50 years old by that point. I actually think his music is more modern and more inventive than often it's felt to be. The works which people tend to be familiar with, the second and third piano concertos, date from before the October Revolution. They're from the last years of the Russian Empire. They are that sumptuous grand world of yesteryear that was swept away both by the World War One and by the October Revolution. When he goes into emigration, he first moves to Scandinavia, but just after a year there, he heads to New York, and he spends most of his life in New York and then later in California, coming back to Europe in the summer. Those works from that period are much less familiar to us, and they show that he was not cutting himself off from contemporary music. He was listening to it. He disliked an awful lot of it. He thought it was written with the head and not with the heart. He thought it was music that was written according to a sort of prescribed script with an idea, a mental plan behind it, but not with any emotional sincerity. And above all, he believed in emotional sincerity and truth. But nonetheless, he was aware of contemporary music, and there are some knowing nods towards those, but they're done in a very clever way that really are only that's only available if you're interested in pursuing that particular avenue and that particular inquiry. If you just want to listen to music in its own terms, it's fully accessible and engaging. But I know what you mean about some classical music concerts not always welcoming in the listener by their musical language. I think many people do find that.
So what led you to write about and research Rachmaninoff at this particular time?
So I've long been interested in Russian music. Here in Wadham, I'm the fellow and tutor in Russian, which means that I teach mainly language and literature. But I've always had a strong interest in music, and I play for my own pleasure. And over the years, I've spent much more of my research time devoting myself to Russian music. In 2016, I wrote a biography of Tchaikovsky, which I think was an important work for me to write. And it was also a work which I think changed some people's perceptions of what I work on. And I've been doing a lot more work on Russian music since then. So in 2019, I was approached by Bard College, a liberal arts college in upstate New York in Annandale-on-Hudson. They have a wonderful annual music festival, which is always devoted to the work of one composer. And over the course of two long weekends, the festival explores a particular composer, not just their works, but the works of their teachers, of their contemporaries, of their enemies, their critics. And it also looks at their influence and their legacy. So it's designed to be a music festival, but with a particular kind of selling point, a particular kind of immersive way of understanding a composer and his work. Last year, they had the first woman composer. That's great. Nice. Deal of interest in contemporary musicology and reclaiming the legacy of women musicians in a field which is still dominated by men, of course. So in 2019, the team at Bard approached me to ask if I might be interested in coming as scholar in residence to the festival, which I'll be doing later this summer, and we might talk about. But the first duty of the scholar in the scholar in residence is to produce a book, which is called X and His World, or we hope increasingly in future, X and Her World. And so my book is called Rachmaninoff and His World. It's just been published by Chicago University Press. And it's a volume of essays by scholars from Europe, from North America, and from Russia. And it aims to explore the whole of Rachmaninoff's life and work from a number of vantage points, cultural, literary, historical, musicological. And that book comes out in the run-up to the festival. And the two are sort of hand in hand, as it were. And the book is an academic book. It's published by a wonderful, wonderful press. But it is designed to be accessible to non-specialists. There aren't too many scary musical examples, but there are a number of them. But it's written in a way which presupposes no formal technical training. And it is designed not just to address important academic questions, but also to engage the wider public interested in, be it classical music, be it Russian culture, and use Rachmaninoff as a way of getting a little bit sort of further into that field. So I've spent really the last 3 years editing that book. Things were held up a little bit by the pandemic, but my authors have been wonderfully patient in that process. And I picked a group of scholars, as I said, international scholars, some known for their work on Rachmaninoff, but others not, but whom I knew had an interest in him. And I gave them carte blanche to write on the questions that interested them. And over the last few years, there's been a wonderful back and forth with them, shaping their essays, finding wonderful illustrations to give it some texture and some character. And we finished in early March and sent it off to the publisher then. And I'm incredibly grateful to them for their
congratulations. That's quite a festival invite with a commitment attached to write an entire book. Wow.
Yes, but it's a real joy to be allowed to tackle a major composer. And as I said, a major composer who hasn't always been accorded the critical kudos that I think he deserves. So I hope that as well as drawing in general readers, music fans, it will also do some important academic work, moving on the debate, asking how we write the history of 20th century music, how we write the history of Russian music, a field which was split between Russia and an emigre culture for large parts of the 20th century. So I hope it will also do some important academic work as well. But it's been an absolute joy to work with the press and the whole team at Bard College, who've been incredibly supportive, have helped read all the chapters, have made very constructive suggestions, and who have helped me see the book into production, mostly while we've all been at home and reading things online and not being able to go to concerts and make live music.
Indeed. I mean, my very reasonable guess is that this is not the first book to be written on Rachmaninoff. So maybe you could just hone in a bit on what you think the unique contribution of this book is.
Yes. There have been a number of good books on Rachmaninoff. Shortly after his death, there was a small spate of books, many of them written by people who knew him, many curated by family members or members of his circle who wanted to really establish a biography and a narrative of his work. In 1973, there was a lot more work, particularly coming out of the Soviet Union, publications of letters, documents. That was the 100th anniversary of his birth, of course, and that led to another wave of often very fine scholarship. I think a lot of that scholarship was written, as I said, against the backdrop of a critical consensus which deemed Rachmaninoff to be old-fashioned, a romantic composer, a hangover of the 19th century who lived long beyond his sell-by date. I think that has not been a view many of us have held for some time, actually. And the book, I think, makes an important contribution, interestingly, to seeing Rachmaninoff as modern, but not as modernist. He was someone who didn't just bury himself in the past. He was very engaged with new audiences, the new mechanisms of celebrity. He, in his American years, was a great interviewee with Good Housekeeping, with Vogue, with all kinds of popular publications, as well as music publications. He was very keen to use that kind of celebrity status to put across classical music to a very wide audience in early 20th century America. I also think one of the things I was very keen to do in the book was to devote full attention to his American years and the years he lived in Europe. Even before he emigrated, he was a regular visitor to Western Europe. He spent 3 years living in Dresden between 1906 and 1909. He regularly visited Switzerland and Italy. He performed in Britain. He was aware of currents well outside of the Russian Empire. And I think the other thing about Rachmaninoff's reputation is that sometimes we've sort of overdone his Russianness. We've wanted to make him a kind of emanation of the Russian soul and all of that kind of myth-making. And yes, he was. He loved his homeland. He was bereft when he left Russia in 1917 and spoke about the loss until his death. He always thought of himself as Russian. He only became an American citizen towards the very end of his life. He spoke Russian with his friends and family. He lived a very Russian lifestyle, even in emigration. But I think that does him a disservice to sort of pigeonhole him too much. He was very interested in the music of Wagner, of Richard Strauss. He was interested in interwar French music, American music. And the book tries to tell the full story of him as an émigré who didn't shut himself off from the world in which he found himself when he left his homeland. And we may come on to politics and contemporary Russia at the moment, but within Russia, there is often an attempt to sort of reclaim their own heroes. There was, several years ago, even an attempt to repatriate his body. He's buried in New York State, in Kensico Cemetery in Valhalla. And the Russian Minister of Culture actually tried to propose that he'd be exhumed and taken back to his homeland. And that's a sort of silly story in many ways. And it didn't come to pass. But it's indicative of a broader mindset that says we must see authors or musicians as painters only in their national contexts. And I'm really keen in all my academic work to pay attention to the cross-border, the transnational, the stories of exile and migration, the way that many of us have other lives, other languages, other selves. And so the book, I think a thread that runs throughout it is this attention paid to him as a Russian composer outside of his homeland and how he interacted with that experience and the events that took place there.
That's great. So if I'm tracking correctly, it sounds like what you're aiming to do in this collection is firstly to bring out that reappraisal of him as a serious figure worthy of scholarly attention, to draw out the time periods in his life that have been somewhat neglected relative to other parts, and also just to study him as a more fully orbed human being with a kind of more richly complex identity than being some kind of Platonic abstract form of being a Russian. Is that, am I tracking you correctly?
That's spot on. I clearly need to ask you to write all my book covers, conference abstracts, introductions and everything. You've distilled that much better than I could have done myself. Thank you, Martin.
Very kind. So I'm interested to know, just either in your own research or in your conversations with colleagues and contributors to the book, are there particular things that have really stood out to you or that you feel like you've learned that are surprising or new?
I think one always finds new things about even the most familiar figure. Merely rereading, when I began the project, all of his letters, all of his interviews, was a very important exercise. It's not a biography. My previous book was a biography. But like a biography, you can't just ignore things that you don't know about, or you can't just bracket them off just because you haven't got time. And so I did find myself coming across all kinds of new things that I new ways of looking at old things or things that I hadn't seen in the same depth or the same complexity before. I think one of the chapters by Peter Franklin, who's emeritus professor of music here at Oxford, that chapter really opened my eyes to his time in Germany and his engagement with modern German music, particularly in the Dresden years. That's just one example where one of the authors revealed that to me. There are three chapters on the operas. And we seldom hear Rachmaninoff's operas, and they're often deemed unstageable. Yet my three wonderful authors, Emily Frey, Karen Emerson, and Simon Morrison, all of them took me into a greater understanding of the complexities of the libretti and the music in ways that I probably ought to have known myself in advance. So every chapter contains either a biographical fact or a way of looking at the facts of the life, or has an interpretative framework. There's a lovely chapter by Rebecca Mitchell, who's just published a biography of Rachmaninoff with Reaction Press, that looks at Moscow in the late 19th and early 20th century, not through the prism of tradition and old-fashionedness, but through modernity, through new road-building projects, through new architectural projects, sees the city as a space of change, and that was very exciting to read her work as a historian. I was able to bring in a Russian colleague, Marina Raku, who really looked at Rachmaninoff's reputation in the Soviet Union. Now, Rachmaninoff left in 1917. He was part of the White Russian emigration. He should not have been a figure who figured on the concert programs of Soviet artists. He wasn't a Bolshevik. He wasn't a revolutionary. Yet, why were not just performers, but audiences and indeed the party interested in not just tolerating, but celebrating his music? That story emerged. I haven't got time to go through every chapter, but each chapter contains a new story or new material or a new way of thinking. And all of the authors were very keen to apply this, yes, reappraisal, this revisionist prism to the story they told.
Listeners will have to buy the book to read all the rest of those juicy findings.
I do hope you all will. Yes, it's available in hardback and paperback and as an ebook. And I'm sure my publishers will be very pleased for me to mention that.
So you said that the origin of this book is connected to your involvement with the Bard Music Festival. Could you flesh out a bit more what your involvement with that festival is, how the book ties into that?
Yeah. So the book is not the programme of the festival. They're separate things, but they're intimately linked. The festival takes place over two long weekends in August. We begin on the 5th of August and go through to the 7th, and then start again on the 12th, finishing on the 14th of August this summer. And in those two long weekends, we will have 12 concerts examining aspects of Rachmaninoff's life. And like the book, the festival falls in two halves. There's a Russian half, and then there's a half that we've called New Worlds, so both America but Europe, but that general idea of newness. And we'll be looking at, as I said, a wide range of Rachmaninoff's music, but setting it alongside his teachers, his contemporaries, his rivals, his critics, but also those figures who had very different existences, but in parallel to his. Now, the team at Bard programmed this, but I've been very closely involved in making suggestions, in offering feedback on programmes. We've had lots and lots of Zoom conversations, and in the last year, some in-person conversations when we've been able to meet, when we found ourselves in the same city or on the same continent, to really just talk about what would make a satisfying programme for the listeners. So the book complements it, but the festival has its own rationale. There will be a separate booklet program for the festival, and I've written the introductory essay. I've written essays for a couple of the concerts. I'll be giving some pre-concert talks. I'll be taking part in some panel discussions. So I'll be very visible at all of the events, trying to represent academic scholarship, but in an engaging, accessible way for non-specialist audiences. And I'll be doing that with several other colleagues who'll be flying out to Bard over the summer. So it'll be a real chance for many of the world's experts on Russian and American music to gather in one place to hear some great music and to communicate what we love about this repertoire to audiences who we hope also love it. But if they don't yet love it, we hope they'll come to love it over the course of those two long weekends.
Great. So you spoke about how, you know, you want to make your scholarship and that of your colleagues engaging and, you know, present it in that way at this festival. When I think about the usual activities of an academic, I maybe picture when they are kind of presenting, being at a conference of some sort, presenting to other learned scholars. And this seems like a bit of a different event where it's much more public facing, much more of a blend. So I was wondering how more generally you view the interaction between engaging the public and producing your scholarship.
It's a really, really good question. I suppose the facile answer is that I'm a failed performer. So doing these events allows me to hang out with really great performers and occasionally get on the stage, turn some pages and just get a little bit of the grease paint and the excitement of live music making. But, you know, more seriously, there are very good reasons for doing this. I think sometimes within the academic world, particularly the humanities, there's a kind of narrative of crisis. The subjects which dominate the headlines are the STEM subjects, the science, technology, engineering, maths. They're the things that are going to get you a great salary. They're going to change the world. You can apply your knowledge. And people wonder, what's the value of the humanities? Why study the humanities? Now, I'm sure people listening to this podcast know full well what the value of the humanities is. Many of them will have degrees in the humanities. And I think in a college like this, social scientists, humanities scholars, scientists all live and work together. So we don't feel that difference. But more broadly, there can be a narrative of crisis and crisis of the humanities. If we take a step back, though, and we look at what we study, history, music, literature, painting, there's a great appetite for that out there. People are always downloading podcasts, listening to In Our Time, attending galleries, going to the theatre, going to the cinema, going to concerts in interesting places. People find these products of the artistic imagination integral to what we are as human beings. And that's what we work on here. So why wouldn't you want to sort of celebrate that and work with that? So one of the reasons for doing these kind of public-facing events and collaborations with performing and arts organisations is that they renew my confidence in the importance of what we do. There might be a more instrumental aspect. The creative and performing arts form a huge part of our national economy. They always have, and increasingly they have. They're one of our big exports, like higher education, of course. They're one of the things that we might want to celebrate about the world in which we live here. And I want to be very confident and frank and unabashedly positive and enthusiastic about the importance of those. But I don't think it's just about economic added value and an instrumental way of looking at the humanities and the arts. As we emerge from the pandemic, yes, of course, we pay tribute to the vaccine scientists who came up with a vaccine that's got us back to in-person music making and in-person tutorials, in-person lectures and all of those things, and got us off online work. But what also got us through the pandemic, and why, what are we going to do with our lives now that we can do things again? It's to go to the cinema together. It's to go to the galleries. It's to go to concerts. It's to do things collectively. What got us through the pandemic? It was doing things at home online. It was watching those things. So I really want to celebrate that aspect as well of the centrality of these to our national life, to our international life, but also to our sort of being as humans. This is what makes us tick. And in a place like Wadham, actually, I don't feel the separation between the arts and the sciences. So this emerges very naturally out of the sense of community that shapes what we do here. We make music together. We talk about books together. We find out about scientific discoveries together. I feign knowledge when someone talks about social policy and economics. But I think it's that holistic sense of what makes us human beings that's so exciting. One final thing. It's very easy to see collaborations with arts and performing arts organisations as kind of one way. I'm being bussed in as the expert and I'm standing on the stage kind of orating to an expectant audience. That's a little bit of it, of course. Yes, we've spent years, those of us who are in academia, learning our subjects. We know it profoundly and intimately. But working with an organisation such as Bard College means that I'm collaborating. Working with these audiences is two-way. I learn from them. I get an awful lot. I measure what I do. I calibrate my ideas. I get a sense of what matters to them by listening as much as by talking. And I think it's that mutuality that's really, really important about public engagement with research, knowledge exchange. Those are the jargon words in the field. But it is a profoundly two-way exercise, I feel. So it's not just me turning up, delivering, communicating, and then walking away. I hope that in a good instance of this kind of relationship, I will go away as changed and as an enhanced by the experience as I hope the audiences will be.
And for another small plug, any listeners can go attend this festival, I'm sure, and interact with you in that two-way format.
If any of you are in North America, in New York State, or within driving or flying distance, tickets are on sale. So please come and listen to wonderful music, hear some wonderful talks by my colleagues and friends. And if you are coming, I'd be only too happy to know about it. So let me know so that I can look out for you at the interval or at a drinks reception or at any point. I'll be out there for 2 or 3 weeks in the summer and delighted to connect with Wadham alumni and any of your friends and family. That would make me very happy indeed.
So I'm aware that over this session, we've spoken a lot about Russian culture and just given the current circumstance with Ukraine, it seems appropriate just to acknowledge that for a moment and just kind of ask just for yourself how the unfolding conflict has shaped your own thinking as a scholar of Russian culture and what that means at this particular time.
Yes, it's the conversation we have all the time with each other, with our graduate students, with our undergraduates, with our colleagues in Russia and Ukraine and around the world. We have no obvious easy answers at the moment. What I might say is those of us who've been working on Russian culture all our lives have been facing this question not just since the 24th of February, but since 2014 and the annexation of Crimea and the unresolved conflict in Donbass. And so we have been thinking through these questions profoundly, even if maybe some of the results of that thinking haven't been obvious to the outside world. I think I've been very keen in my teaching and scholarship always to think about the legacy of empire from the medieval period onward. Russia thought of itself in imperial terms. It expanded, it annexed territory, it incorporated other peoples into its space. In the 19th century, it thought of itself explicitly as multi-ethnic, multilingual, multicultural. And the legacy of that fed into the Soviet experience as well. So that question has been integral to our teaching and our research. I've been thinking a lot about how we can reflect that in our undergraduate and graduate curriculum, the kind of texts we study, be it by Russian authors who were writing about the Russian campaign in the Caucasus in the first half of the 19th century, or an author I love, Isaac Babil, who wrote about the Polish-Soviet War during the Russian Civil War, and what that can tell us about the relationship between Russia and its neighbours, or teaching the prose of the 19th century Ukrainian-born Nikolai Gogol, and how we might understand his career as a writer in Russian. So it's been integral to our teaching and research for a long time. I've wanted in my teaching in particular to bring in a far wider range of Russophone voices. This goes for all modern languages. To study French allows you to access not just literature produced in France, but Francophone writing from around the globe. To study Spanish is the same. Portuguese is the same. All of these languages have their complex, contested legacies of colonialism and empire, and Russia is no different. So I bring into my teaching writers active in the Russian language, but based in the Caucasus, in Central Asia, in Israel, in North America, in Ukraine, where Russian is one of the languages that is still spoken. And so I think reflecting that complexity in how we teach is an important pedagogical exercise, but has been for a long time. I think many of us are keen through public-facing work, through translation, through podcasting, through interviews, to get that narrative more widely understood by the broader public, who might perhaps see Russia as one thing, whereas in fact it can be many things. It has a rich and very complex and often challenging and often tragic history. The other thing that I have been doing a lot of well before February this year is working with colleagues in Ukraine, in Belarus, whether they're there or whether they are now outside of those countries. When it comes to theatre making, I've been part of a big research project here at Oxford, which looks at Russophone drama by dramatists in Belarus, Ukraine, and Russia, which began long before this conflict, but which was partly carried out under the shadow of the 2014 annexation of Crimea. I've also been using the understanding that I have as a historian and scholar of not just Russian culture, but of the Russian Empire and of the Soviet Union, to understand the place of countries like Ukraine in that narrative. I'm working very closely with Oxford Lida, one of the city's great cultural outfits. We're doing a recital later this week of Ukrainian art songs, and I will be speaking between the performances to help illuminate the biographies of the composers we'll be hearing. We'll be doing events in the autumn in the Lida Festival to bring forward those stories, those narratives, which aren't always heard outside. So it's the trickiest, most tragic, most difficult moment I've known in my professional career, and I don't have any obvious answers to the geopolitical crisis. How could I have? I'm not trained in that regard, but all I can do is bring my cultural understanding to bear, both on how I teach, how I support the next generation of graduate students who may not be able to go to Russia for some time soon, and also to communicate these stories, these narratives and these interpretations to readers and listeners who really want to know what's going on beneath the headlines and behind those awful pictures that we see daily on our news and hear about on the radio. I don't know whether it's enough. It can never be enough, but it's the very small amount that I can do. And to come back to Rachmaninoff, we thought long and hard about what it meant to do a festival devoted to his music this summer. It's not to justify it or explain it away, but this was a composer who left his homeland in 1917. He was displaced because of warfare and revolution. And then who, when Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union in 1941, put aside those political that political distaste he had for Soviet Russia to support the Red Army, which was not just a Russian army, but was a Soviet army made up of many nationalities and peoples to repel Nazi Germany. So that's not an answer, but in Rachmaninoff's own story, there is one of those sadly tragic and recurring narratives of displacement, of loss. And maybe that's one way of thinking through the present crisis, at least in my own work.
Philip, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for sharing. If people want to connect with you online, where can they find you?
Well, I'm quite low tech, so I'm not on Instagram or Twitter, or certainly not on TikTok and all of these things, but I have a web page on the college homepage and on the faculty page of the Faculty of Medieval and Modern Languages. People can find my email address there. They can find a full list of all of the kind of things I'm up to in various places. And I look forward to hearing perhaps from some old students, from some alums that I haven't met before, and maybe in Bard this summer, perhaps some of you there as well. I'd be looking forward to that. And thank you for your time and questions and the conversation today.
I'll include the link to your webpage on the show notes. And thanks again.
Thank you.